Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is happening to your brain? Most of us use technology for hours every day, and in many cases we are using more than one medium. We're text messaging, searching, or contributing to online content, watching videos, and listening to music. Research shows we are getting better at handling ourselves in this brave new virtual world, but there is also evidence we're losing a skill that served humankind for eons, the ability to read and respond to other people in face-to-face interactions. Neuroscientist Dr. Gary Small has seen this in his work as director of the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA. His new book, co-written with Gigi Vorgan, is called iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Gary, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be in the show.
So let's start by talking about this brain gap. You have the digital native and the digital immigrant. Who are they and what separates them?
Well, what we have is all this technology, as you mentioned. It's everywhere, 24/7. And younger people are the digital natives, those who have grown up with this technology from a very young age. They're very comfortable with it. They use it all the time. They have multitasking brains that are pretty much hardwired to deal with this stuff. You have the digital immigrants who came to the technology later in life, grew up in a time when there was more involvement in face-to-face communication. I'm a digital immigrant, and to me, high-tech was a push-button phone or a remote control. So it's a very different group of people. And so instead of the traditional generation gap, we have what I call a brain gap because of the differences in the brain wiring. And what iBrain proposes is we take note of these changes and try to bridge the brain gap by upgrading the tech skills of the digital immigrants and helping younger people with their human contact skills.
Yeah, one of the things that worries you, even for digital natives, is what you call techno burnout.
It is a problem. You know, and we can think of it in our own lives. This is all about something happening throughout the world, yet it's very personal. And if each of us thinks about how we use technology, whether we're a native or an immigrant, we probably have experiences where we have been doing email for several hours on end or working on the computer for something else, and you feel sort of a brain fog. You don't have the increased attention span. You have you're distractible. You may have a problem with your memory. And it's important to try to gauge ourselves, not overdo it, take tech breaks.
Yeah, it seems like what a lot of people do now, instead of taking a break from technology, they'll take a break from that task, and then they'll click over and read the news for a while or shop for something, but remain online. And that's not good enough.
Well, I think it's better than continuing the task over and over and over. And in fact, studies have found if we continue on end, we really make more errors and we're not as efficient despite the impression that we're being efficient.
I think this is really interesting. You have found research to show that internet reading activates more brain regions than just sitting there with a hard copy bit of text. What accounts for that?
We think that the internet, when we're searching online, it's a much more interactive experience. You're making decisions from moment to moment. Should you pursue one web page versus another? And what we found was when we put digital immigrants, and actually some of these people had very little computer experience before they did the study, when we put them in the functional MRI scanner, we find that when they read a simulated text page, it activates the visual cortex, other areas of the brain that control language, what you'd expect to see when someone reads a book. When we gave them a searching online task, we found a much greater activation, but only in people who had had prior experience. And it was more than a twofold increase in the extent of activation in the brain. And it was especially activated in the front part of the brain that controls decision-making and complex reasoning.
So it would sound like the digital immigrants who did not have experience being online were at a disadvantage. But I have to wonder if some of that came from the fact that they weren't familiar with the technology, they didn't know what to expect, whereas people who had done it before are sort of aware that a decision is coming and they need to get themselves ready for that.
Well, I think that's exactly how we explain part of the results of this study, that we think when people first go online or they do any novel mental task, our brains don't quite know what to do. We're a little bit confused. We're trying to figure it out. And if you do a brain scan, you don't see a lot of activation. Once we figure out a strategy for solving the mental task, then you see increased activation. And in fact, if you repeat that task over and over again, then you see greater cognitive efficiency. You'll see less activation. So the brain actually gets very efficient in performing the task.
So we create these new neural pathways when we're online a lot and we have to perform these tasks. What are we likely to sacrifice in return for finding new ways to use our brains when we're using technology?
What our iBrain argues is that we're sacrificing what has traditionally defined our humanity, our ability to sit down and have a conversation with someone, look them in the eye, observe nonverbal cues, and interpret them. That's the sacrifice. And there is some evidence to support that. Certainly we know in terms of time, if you're spending an hour online, you're going to spend less time with people face-to-face. It's just a simple math. Secondly, there are some initial studies showing that young people who play video games have more difficulty recognizing the emotional expression on a person's face. So while we're firing up those online neural circuits, we're sort of not strengthening the ones that we need to really communicate with people directly.
What's horrible about this is thinking, well, maybe people were better off watching TV all the time.
You know, I've actually heard myself say to my son, Harry, get off that computer game and come downstairs and watch television with me. So I think, people tend to think, well, it's either technology being good or bad. It's, it's good and it's bad. There are positive aspects of searching online or watching television. It's the context, it's the content, it's the duration of the activity. And it's always best to balance these activities, not do any one for extended periods of time, but try to vary them, both the online types of activities and also the offline activities.
I know that scientists have observed for some time that women are more adept at reading social cues and emotions than men tend to be.
My wife keeps telling me that.
but it is backed up by science, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if women are becoming more like men the more time they spend online.
Well, we're seeing that in the trends in computer use, that men in the past have been the higher users, but women are catching up very much so. And I think we're seeing some of these gender differences breaking down because the technology it's so seductive. It's so much fun. It lures us. We have a whole chapter in iBrain on technology addiction. And even if you're not a full-blown tech addict, many people will admit that they have a little trouble giving up their email, that it's always in their PDA and they always want to keep up with it. And they have a hard time letting go.
I really like that chapter, Gary, because I think it did the best job I have read to date of explaining how and why the internet and that kind of technology can be addictive. It's not just a matter of people not having the discipline to go do something else. It's about the little reward you get when you search for information and then suddenly there it is.
It's this principle that psychologists talk about, operant conditioning, meaning that a consequence of a behavior will reinforce that behavior. And so what you see with emails, it's very much like what happens with gambling. Most of the email messages are not that interesting. They're either boring or it's spam or something you don't want to deal with. But every once in a while, there's a great email where you've got a raise or somebody finally answered a request, and it makes you happy. And it makes you want to keep going back and back and back until you get another one of those emails. And it's more reinforcing than if all the emails were great. You just take it for granted.
Dr. Gary Small is my guest. He's a neuroscientist and director of the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA. His new book is called iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the American Mind. What skills do we gain from exposure to technology?
Studies have found that we can increase our peripheral vision. We can increase our hand-eye coordination, our reaction time. So you can imagine if you're playing these action video games over and over again, you're going to improve some of your cognitive skills. studies have found that surgeons who play video games actually make fewer errors in the operating room. And there are new programs that are being developed or have been developed to improve memory ability and mental acuity, particularly in middle-aged and older people who have age-associated memory loss. So, you know, there's a whole opportunity here to improve our minds through the technology. So it's, again, it's not all bad. In addition, we have the remarkable increase in our working efficiency. We can work on manuscripts and documents, exchange information very quickly. We can contact people throughout the world any time of day. It's really made our world smaller and much more efficient.
I know that many different professions, medical students and military pilots, use these simulation programs now to try and assist with training and get as close to reality as possible. Does the brain make a distinction between an event or an interaction that takes place through this artificial device, a computer, as opposed to one that takes place in the real world?
It does. The brain is very sensitive to input, sensory input from moment to moment. If I read a word versus think of a word, you'll have a very different brain activation pattern if you measure it. And so if we're seeing something online, if we're reading it on a computer screen, it's going to be different input compared to picking up a book. Now, having said that, our technology is advancing tremendously, and we're developing virtual worlds, and there's even programs that we talked about how the action computer games may impair our ability to read facial expressions. There are computer programs that help people actually improve that ability. So as the technology improves more and more, there's going to be less of a distinction between virtual online activity and real-world activity.
So maybe we need to change our brains in order to fit with all of these great things we're inventing.
I think it's happening. Whether we like it or not, the technology train is charging down the track, and we have to think about how it's affecting us and how we can adapt, because it's not going to go away. It's only going to continue.
Yet you see this as the greatest period of change for the way that humans use their intellect since the beginning of technology at all.
I think so. I argue in iBrain that it's going to be the next major milestone in brain evolution. An example of how the environment may change and affect our brain development was seen some time ago when our ancestors first figured out how to use a handheld tool. That led to complex reasoning and thinking of future strategies to try to figure out how to do this, how to make this tool. It led to handedness. It led to grammatical language, more complex social networks. And along with that, there was coevolution of the frontal lobe of the brain. And so our brains grew. Now we have an environment where there's lots of technology, and the question is, how are we going to adapt? What will the next generation look like?
Dr. Gary Small is my guest. We're talking about his new book, iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. We'll be back in just a moment and invite you to get on the line now to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. If you prefer, you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neuroscientist Dr. Gary Small. He is director of the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA and author of the book iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Gary, you were talking about evolution, and this might be the next thing to sort of trigger that. I have to wonder, though, if technology is evolving at such a more rapid rate than any species with a lifespan like ours has ever done, is it even possible for us to catch up?
Well, I think we can catch up. We're catching up. The next generation is doing that quite well. I mean, you have a group of young people, the digital natives, who are exquisitely adept at the new technology. As a digital immigrant, I tend to use email, and I don't use text messaging until my teenage daughter taught me how to text message. And I notice how effective she is in getting her message across with the handheld device, and she does it quite quickly. So you can see how quickly young brains adapt to this. And it makes sense because a young developing mind is very plastic and very malleable. In fact, a young brain goes through a process we call pruning, meaning that 60% of the neural circuits or synapses, the connection sites between the neurons or brain cells, are pruned away throughout development. So there's a lot of opportunity for change and learning. This is probably one reason that young people can pick up languages so quickly and musical instruments. The concern, however, is you have a teenager whose frontal lobe is not fully developed. They don't have the complex reasoning and planning skills in place. Their empathy skills are not as developed as an older person. So the question is, if they're spending on average nearly 9 hours a day with the technology, how will it affect the development of their brain?
So your concern is that we prune away empathy for the sake of the ability to deal with all this technology.
Yes. So that's a concern, but I don't know the answer. I don't know what it will look like, and I don't know what the next generation will look like. But if you think of Darwin's principle of natural selection, if you have a change in the environment, the genetic variation that adapts the best will survive. So what will the next generation look like that has this technology everywhere?
Do you think it's possible to prune less, to suddenly, you know, retain 60% as opposed to 40% of what we were born with?
I don't think we can do that. I think our brains are just pre-wired to go through this pruning process. So there's only so much we can maintain in our consciousness. I mean, it's an interesting theory. It'd be a hard experiment to do. What you might want to do is make sure that you cross-train your brain enough to limit some of the pruning process. I don't know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about the book iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Let's speak to Raj in Allen. Hi, Raj.
Hi, Chris. I'm a first-time caller. I enjoy your program.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks. I have a question for Dr. Small. You mentioned that young people who play a lot of video games and watch a lot of television have lesser or lower social skills than young people who do not. If you were to extrapolate that to babies, do babies who watch more television, do they stand a higher risk of having autism? Can you talk about the state of research on the relatedness of technology, television, or video games to autism?
Sure. There has actually been some concern not only about autism, but also about attention deficit disorder. There have been several studies that have shown an association between worse symptoms of ADHD or attention deficit and greater time spent watching videos or playing video games and watching television. And in fact, because of that association, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended no videos and no television for children under two. That's a controversial recommendation. Some pediatricians will say, well, it has more to do with the content of the videos and how much time is spent. And also they would argue that a cause and effect relationship has never been established definitively. That is, it may be that kids who have attention deficit are drawn to the television more. You know, many families have seen it that their kids do better when they limit the computer and television time. The connection with autism is probably more controversial, and it stemmed in large part from a study done not long ago by an economist who noticed, well, in his own son, who was very young, had a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. He turned off the television, and he noticed he improved. Now, let me say that for these kinds of problems, often what's recommended at a young age is intensive interventions where there's speech therapy, occupational therapy, and this has been found to improve these patients. Well, this economist did a study where he looked at the precipitation or rainfall in California, Oregon, and Washington, states where there was a lot of variation in precipitation rates. And he found that there was a very strong correlation between the rates of autism and the level of rainfall. And the thinking was that if there's more rainfall, the kids are spending more time indoors watching television.
So there are questions about whether there could be external causes of things like autism or of ADHD, as you mentioned earlier briefly. There's a really interesting chapter in the book where you talk about the consequences of paying sort of partial attention all the time to multiple things as being a cause of, if nothing else, a constant level of stress in the body. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think that's something that we often do, whether we're digital immigrants or digital natives. We have these powerful tools of communication, and you know, even as I sit here, I notice out of the corner of my eye when an email pops on the screen, and it's a little bit distracting. There's the sense of a pull, interested in what's going on there. Is there when something new coming in? And it's not a great way to focus attention. It takes our mind off of the mental task at hand and makes us feel less connected to the conversation, to the person who we should be paying attention to, and I think it is stressful. It triggers another part of the brain that causes stress hormones to be released. And studies have found that if you have chronic stress, you're going to have higher cortisol levels, and cortisol impairs memory and may very well shrink the memory centers of the brain if you have enough of it over a long period of time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to speak to Dr. Gary Small. Let's go next to Margie in Dallas. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Chris, I was just curious about something the doctor had mentioned earlier about the way the brain processes things that, say, we read on a computer screen versus something that we actually read from a book. And I was curious about these new devices they have that are the electronic devices that hold say, several novels and different magazines, things like that. Is that something that there's a concern about, or is he referring to something that maybe I just need a little more clarification on?
Yeah, thanks for your question. I express concern when something is repeated and intense and it interferes with our daily lives. And I think we need to understand these technologies, but I want to be clear that I'm not against technology. I'm a big fan of it, and I emphasized earlier some of the upside. And you bring up the electronic books, which I think are a marvelous innovation. And in fact, it's interesting, the groups that tend to be really interested in it are older digital immigrants. You'd think, well, you know, they're reluctant. They like to read their newspaper in the morning and not read the newspaper online. Well, they like the electronic books because they can increase the font size. It's easier on their eyes, and if they go on vacation, they don't have to take a whole bunch of books, which can be very heavy. They can have them all inside the electronic reader. So I think it's something we want to take note of. It's not necessarily bad, and in fact, the innovations can really improve our lives. There are other, I mentioned the computer programs to improve memory. there are computer programs to help young people with learning disabilities overcome some of those problems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Our email address is think@kera.org. Is there, Gary, some kind of evolutionary advantage to the fact that, older folks tend to find change more difficult to accept than younger people?
That's an interesting question, whether it is an advantage or not. I think if we think strictly in terms of evolution, probably what older people do or don't do has very little effect on the next generation of genetic material. So it's an interesting question. I don't think it would have an evolutionary advantage one way or another. And one might even argue if somebody is younger and they're taking more risk, wouldn't that be a disadvantage? Unless, of course, there was a reward to that risk.
1-800-933-5372 is the number. Let's speak next to Dimitri in Dallas. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi, Chris. Great show again. Thanks.
Thank you.
Just curious about what the doctor would think about the computer physically interfacing with the human brain and if he sees that happening soon. I know there's been some other shows where they've been doing that on rats and things, but just curious on his own take, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great topic, and in fact, I'm fascinated by it. In iBrain, we have a whole chapter on the future brain and what we might see in generations to come. There are research studies going on right now looking at brain computer interface technologies, and it began a number of years ago when they took epileptic patients who were having surgery and placed electrodes directly on to the brain. And they found that just by using their minds, thinking about it, these patients could control a computer cursor and type. Now they have sensors that can be placed on the scalp. It doesn't have to be directly on the brain. And these research volunteers can type, I think, up to 15 words a minute just by their thoughts. So it's a very exciting technology. I saw recently that there's a new computer game company that is using this technology to operate the game with some kind of headgear. And it may be in the future, we'll be, instead of wearing Bluetooth earpieces, we'll be wearing little scalp sensors. And if you want to meet your friend for a cup of coffee, you just think about it. It goes on your PDA and through the Wi-Fi network, and they'll meet you there without ever having to talk to them. Now, the downside would be you have to wear tinfoil over your head so people don't read your mind.
Well, you'd have no excuse for ever saying you didn't get the message either.
That's right. Well, you could say your sensor battery was out.
Yeah, there's always going to be something. let's speak next to Terry in Fort Worth. Hey, Terry.
Hi. Yes. Excellent, excellent program. I just wanted to comment. You guys did a previous presentation with a researcher from, I believe it was UT Southwestern Medical School, that was looking at multitasking, and she was doing some active PET brain scans on people that were multitasking versus sequential or single task focused.
And the multitaskers did not do well.
Yes. Basically, she was saying that in people that were strong multitaskers, the portions of the brain that would normally be focused on a task were fragmented. The blood flow, the activity seemed to be fragmented. Taken together with your current guest's speculation about a lack of empathy in later generations. I'm 55, so I started out with an Apple IIe. I find it difficult to multitask along with these folks that are maybe even just less than 5 years younger than myself. I was wondering if you had any comment.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
You know, I think your experience is similar to many other digital immigrants who find multitasking to be challenging. And certainly some of the studies you cite in Dallas and others have looked at multitasking in middle agers. And despite our perception that we're getting a lot done and we're very efficient, it's not a great way to accomplish mental tests. There are there's a much greater likelihood of making errors. Studies have found that if you put in a distractor or multiple distractors, that error rate goes way up. And what we need to do is be aware of multitasking and try to limit it as much as we can. Now, the digital natives, they are multitasking like crazy. I mean, I have a 16-year-old teenage daughter, Rachel, and we call her room the cockpit because she's got so many things going on at once. And many parents complain about this. They say, well, how can they get their homework done? My response is ask how they're performing at school. And it may be that their brains are wiring up. Their pruning process allowed them to develop better multitasking neural networks. I don't know. And as a concerned parent, I'm trying not to be judgmental as long as she gets her job done. And it would be interesting to see how her brain looks and how she multitasks when she becomes middle-aged. Now, you know, let me just, you know, as a brain aging expert, I'm always talking about the downside of the aging brain. Let me just comment on some of the upsides of an aging brain, that we are able to think into the future. Our complex reasoning is better. We have a lifetime of building up mental templates so that we can solve some of these social tasks and complex tasks better. And in fact, there's a process in the brain called myelinization, which means that the wiring in our brain is much faster.
So we've got things to look forward to as well.
That's right. It's not all bad.
Gary Small is my guest. He's a neuroscientist and director of the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA. His new book is called iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. We'll be back in just a moment. There is space if you want to join us on at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neurologist Dr. Gary Small, neuroscientist, and he is also the director of the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA. He's got a new book out called iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we find Nikki in Bedford. Hi, Nikki.
I wanted to explore your comment about empathy and how empathy in children might be adversely affected by their exposure to computers or television.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a parent and I'm a retired teacher. As a parent, I really worked to teach my two children, a boy and a girl, how to be empathetic. I mean, it doesn't come naturally. It needs to be taught. Unlike some, you know, reflexes like swallowing or something like that, I think a lot of people take it for granted that a child becomes empathetic as they grow older. And my experience as a parent and a teacher is almost the opposite, that if children do not learn at a very early age to be empathetic, especially with people who are different than they are, that they become inured to that, and it is a very difficult task to educate them into feeling empathetic for people outside of their group, whatever they consider their group to be.
Thank you so much for your call, Nikki. What do you think about that, Gary?
Well, I think it's true that we do need to teach young people empathic skills, and we can teach them. It is possible to do that. the studies have found that when you test teenagers, you give them different mental tasks that might tap into their empathy abilities, they don't perform as well as, say, people in their 20s or 30s who've had more experience and are able to put themselves in another person's emotional space. So I think it's important. I think the early studies suggest that there could be a problem with the technology. There was this very interesting study where they looked at about 200 students, ages 17 to 23, and they gave them this task of observing a face morph from a neutral expression to either an angry face or a happy face. And they found the video game experience interfered with their ability to recognize the happy face quickly. So there is some evidence that if we distract our neural circuits in too many other tasks, that it could impair some of these abilities.
So is it just spending time online as opposed to human interaction, or is it having been away from human interaction? In other words, if those kids had been, I'm trying to think of something else that is wouldn't involve empathy. If they'd been standing outside bouncing a ball up and down for the same amount of time every day that they were online or watching TV, would they probably have the same kind of empathetic skills?
We don't know the answer to that, and it's a very interesting question. The other thing to consider is that the brain is plastic and malleable, and even if we have someone, for example, who's addicted to video gaming, there's still hope for them that they could be treated and, in a sense, detoxified from that and taught empathy skills. And the brain is very resilient. One could also argue that they have excellent empathy skills when it comes to social networking and connecting with their friends. It's just a different form of empathy that they're experiencing and expressing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. And we have Curtis on the line next in Fort Worth. Hey, Curtis.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to comment on exactly what your guest just mentioned, that digital natives such as myself have a different set of skills that they've developed for socializing online. If you were to take my social circles and my wife's social circles online and in the real world and look at those, they are complete mirror images of each other. My wife has a lot harder time connecting to other people through chat socially, because those tonal cues and those facial cues that she's used to dealing with in the real world aren't there, whereas I have an easier time reading the tone and the emotional state of the person on the other end of the text through the phrasing and what I know of that person.
Well, this is a thank you for commenting. This is a great way to put this into perspective from your own experience, and I think this rings true for so many people. We know from the brain imaging studies as well that the way you communicate the information will trigger different parts of the brain. So if you read a sentence that conveys an emotion, one part of your brain will get excited. If you get that information from an emoticon or from a text message, it'll be a different part of your brain. And here's an example where two people become expert at different ways of communication. What I would argue is the people who really succeed and adapt to the technological revolution are those that have mastered both kinds of skills, the face-to-face human contact skills as well as the technology skills.
Some people seem to form really, really intense relationships with people that they have never met physically, maybe never spoken to on the telephone. You know, they're in chat rooms, they're dating online, they're doing all kinds of things. I'm wondering if some of that intensity is due to the same kind of anonymity that we get when we will shout something horrible at someone who cuts us off in traffic that we would not shout at them if they cut us off at the grocery store.
I think it's an interesting question. And it's something that is facing us more and more today about how the technology affects us emotionally, and we don't really know these people. There have been studies showing that people who prefer using email, they tend to be a little shyer and a little more social phobic, and it makes sense because it's easier for them to look at the email and they can compose a response. They don't have to respond to the person's reaction immediately.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Nita in Dallas. Hi, Nita.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have a question. I am at work, and I am performing a pretty complex task on Excel, and I'm listening to your very, very interesting...
Never a distraction.
...radio program, and I am 51. What effect could this be having on me? I'm just so curious.
Thanks for
Well, you know, you may, I would suggest double checking your Excel spreadsheet because you may have a few errors in it, even though you've enjoyed the program. So I think the multitasking is a reality of our time. It's very difficult to get away from it because the technologies are everywhere. But I think we can become aware of it and we can alter our habits to avoid errors. And iBrain has an entire chapter called the Technology Toolkit to help people with email etiquette, introduce them to new technologies that they're not used to, and know when to make a choice for one technology over another. Sometimes the best response to a string of email conversations is, let's talk.
Yeah, suddenly everything's solved. I have to say, I think the most useful, well, not the most useful thing, but a very interesting thing is this appendix that you have of text message shortcuts, the things that everybody's teenagers seem to have been born knowing that we need to learn to decode.
Yes. What's the one for parents nearby?
And there's parent over shoulder is one of them. Right. And
So I think, you know, there's a whole lexicon that these kids are using that the parents don't know about. And it's important to have conversations and learn about it. Some of the book tour this month I'll be spending talking to parent and teacher groups, going to some of the schools. And one of the schools here in Los Angeles has had a day without technology, asking the kids to go without it for a day and then write an essay and tell us what it felt like.
I wonder, you write in here about people who get addicted, and this is almost like people... it's not like being addicted to alcohol. It's like having a problem with food because you can't just stop using food altogether.
Yeah, it's something that's difficult to treat because the computers and the technologies are always there. So it's a different approach to the addiction, but it's the same parts of the brain that are involved, the dopamine neural circuits, the parts of our brain that are involved in any kind of reward get kicked in when it's an addiction. It can be shopping. It could be games. There are some people who are involved in virtual games like Second Life, where they have avatars that represent themselves. They're spending 12, 14 hours a day in their virtual life and neglecting their real lives.
You are very balanced when it comes down to whether all this technology is good for us or bad for us and what it might mean. I wonder if you think that we get a little too frightened of the changes, even in terms of using, natives versus immigrants. Those are great terms because I think about, families where there's a generation of parents who've come from somewhere else and their kids are natives in the new country. The parents might speak the old language at home and prefer their kids to speak it, and yet they still recognize that their kids have to speak the language of the new country when they're out in the world.
Yes. Yeah, I think iBrain's an opportunity to try to bring together the natives and the immigrants, start conversations, help them understand and respect how each of their generation's brains are working. And, probably this won't be an issue in 40 years. There won't be any immigrants around. Everybody will be a digital native.
We have time for one more call, and that comes from Greg in Dallas. Hi, Greg.
Hey, hi. First-time call.
Welcome.
A similar related issue, I heard you were talking about the distraction. Music, as far as I've had this discussion ever since I was in college. Roommates want to listen to LPs and 8-tracks, and while they're studying, and even now at work, I have people on the iPod at work. My same age, I'm middle-aged, 50. And those
you told us that when you said 8-tracks.
8-track, yeah. Middle-aged, yeah. 8-track, kind of gave it away. So does music fall in the same category? Does your brain process it differently? You know, I had the same problem with my son. He's an iPod user, obviously. So does music fall in the same distraction category?
Well, it can be distracting. I think each of us needs to become aware of what types of multitasking activities work for us or don't work for us. And it's an important thing to do. I think it's important for families to have conversations about this. For example, dinner time is a great time to turn off the technology and have conversations. Studies have found that teenagers who have regular family dinners are less likely to get involved in risk-taking behaviors. Another thing to think about is maybe turning off the technology in the evening and spending time face-to-face. Couples who don't do that, sometimes instead of snoring keeping them awake, it's the worrying of the hard drive.
I think it was in the book that you write about people who are now laptoping in bed, which
yes.
used to be considered just really against the rules.
Well, it depends on the family. I think it's not all good. It's not all bad. We need to understand how it's affecting our brains, how it's affecting our lives, and try to enhance our quality of life.
Any indication, Gary, that education level might have some protective benefits when it comes to unwanted brain changes that might come about from all this online interaction?
Well, there is evidence that if you go to college, you have less mental decline as you age. It's the thinking is use it or lose it. If you exercise your brain cells, you're going to protect them. And we don't know for sure if that's the case, but it certainly is worthwhile thinking about that and trying to balance the sorts of activities we get involved in with our brains.
Since you mentioned that you have teenagers, I'll ask you this. What sorts of parameters have you set up for them in how wired they get to be at any one time?
We try to limit the amount of computer time that the kids have, particularly with the gaming with my son. He likes to play the video games. Now, often we limit it during the week, and he can have more fun with it during the weekend. But I got to tell you, as a parent, it is a challenge to limit the computer time and what they're actually doing with the computers, because a lot of their schoolwork is involved with the computers. I hear them talking in their rooms, and I ask, who are you talking to? And it's their friend they're doing on video conferencing. They're doing their homework together. So I think it's important to be aware of it, to have conversations about it, because as parents, it's going to be very difficult to limit it completely.
And conversely, in the few seconds we have left, any ideas for bringing in maybe an elderly relative into at least a little bit of this immigration into technology?
I think this is a great opportunity to bring in the generations. You have the grandkids teaching the grandparents how to use email, how to search online. Now with our new UCLA study showing that searching on Google actually activates the frontal lobe of your brain, it might be a helpful exercise for the older generation to get involved in.
Great incentive. Dr. Gary Small is director of the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA. His new book is called iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Gary, a fascinating hour. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.